It's time for us to begin this morning. If you open up your Bibles into the New Testament, into the book of Acts in the 15th chapter, we'll be in chapter 15 and cover, we hope, most of the chapter this morning. Verses 1 through 35 is the goal. We should be successful in that journey, but you just never know exactly how things are going to play out. Before we get into our study, though, I would ask if everyone would bow with me in prayer, and we will begin our reading and our conversation after our commune with God. Heavenly Father, we thank you for today. We thank you for the blessings that are found in Jesus. We thank you for the empowerment of the Spirit to bring about the completion of your plan through your word. Help us in all things to be good students, to be servants who honor the King. Please forgive us of our sins and help our faith to mature into victory. And this is our prayer in your Son's name. Amen. All right, so as mentioned, we are in chapter 15. I want to thank Michael for filling in last Sunday when I was unable to be here. And so with that, though, we're going to walk right into the text and talk a little bit about what goes on here what is a combination or a culmination of a series of historical events from the standpoint of how Luke is presenting it to us. With the method that Luke tells the story of first century disciples, he has been introducing key elements of how all this puzzle puts together by using people, that this person represents this story. And if you think back, going to Acts chapter 4 through Acts chapter 14, we can identify some of those key people that shift the story forward. We're introduced in Acts chapter 6, as an example, to some men who meet qualities or criteria to serve the church. It is those men that then tell two key story points going forward. Do you guys remember what those story points were for our servants who are chosen out of the disciples to solve an internal spiritual conflict of how do they make sure this gift of food and service gets distributed equally?
And what was your original question?
Like, who are those people?
Stephen.
Stephen. And then there's another one who's a really awesome named guy.
Philip,
right? Two fantastic individuals, right? They have high quality character. They are noted to us as being with great potential. But immediately, what goes with Stephen? Stephen is just thrown to us, and it's like, this is a really great guy. He's serving the church. He's full of the Spirit. And then what does Luke do with us in that story? Just wrecks us. But he wrecks us to introduce somebody else. So the wrecking of our hearts with Stephen brings us to the table to include whom?
Saul,
right? And Saul and Paul, same person, just two different names for the same guy. And so he brings that person. And what does Saul's story introduce to us? It actually gives us two things of note for right now.
Persecuting.
What was that?
Persecuting.
Persecuting the Jews. But through his conversion, he is told that he has one job in life. He got one. I told you to do one thing, Paul.
Gentiles.
You're going to be my apostle to the Gentiles. Now, Paul, being like a human, does he right away start going to the Gentiles and forget all of his Jewish stuff? Is he just like straight up, I'm Gentile now, I'm going to forget all my Judaism? No, like he goes through his own maturing process. He learns more about not only himself, but also the gospel from these key story points. But then eventually, the man who was kicking against the goats is finally kicked in the right direction to go and bring the gospel to the Gentiles. But his practice stays the same. What's his first stop everywhere he goes?
Synagogue.
Hey, what's up, everybody? My name is Paul. You might have heard me as Saul. And he shares the gospel with them. That's his next kind of step. And Luke tells us these stories through these individuals. So now we've kind of come full circle. We've got this whole story of the gospel going into the Gentiles. It sucked in another messenger or apostle of Jesus. Who's that? Who's our second parte to the story of the gospel to the Gentiles as an apostle? Peter? Right, and that's that little side story, like a subplot that Luke includes. And Peter, who probably of the apostles who were with Jesus before his resurrection, has the least connection with the Gentile world because he's a zealot. He wants the Romans out. He's zealous in behavior. He's ready to fight to secure the Messiah's reign. Has to be corrected. So that whole story sets it up. And then Peter, who says things like, I have never touched anything unclean. I have never eaten anything unclean. Do you guys remember where he has his conversation with the messengers of God regarding this unclean status of, like, what? Who had to be? Who was he staying with? A guy whose name starts with an S.
Simon.
And what's Simon's job?
The tanner.
And what's the deal with a tanner being an Israelite? And what do you touch all the time? Everything's unclean. Like, your whole job is literally not kosher. Not kosher laws, but effectually, he's in an unclean space telling the messenger of God, I never do anything unclean. But that's not the message. The message is the gospel is to the Gentiles. And what you think unclean means, Peter, probably isn't what you thought it was. But more importantly, the gospel goes to the Gentiles too. Now, Peter continues to struggle with this. The Bible tells us that Peter isn't just super perfect in his practice at different points in his life. But that brings us to Acts 15 too. So we wheel the house around to Acts 15 with Paul, who also struggles. He talks about it internally in his writings. Peter, we see it externally. But also Israel, the people of Israel who are now grafted into Christ in the various ways, from natural budding or otherwise. They struggle with it too. They don't know what to do with Gentiles because they're so entrenched into the cultural and spiritual practice of their faith. Like, do these guys have to be circumcised? Because that's a big deal to us. Do they have to keep the law? That's a big deal to us. What about meat? What about meat that's sacrificed to idols? Because that will come down the road a little bit later too. These are all the things that create the backdrop for what Luke, our inspired author, casually introduces in verse 1, but some men came down from Judea and were teaching the brothers, unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. Now, that's the conflict, right? Because what has Peter and Paul been teaching? What have they been saying, as far as we can tell? Have they been saying that?
Yeah.
We have no textual witness that they said anything like that whatsoever. In fact, in the biblical accounts of them preaching and teaching and educating and encouraging and admonishing, do they teach a different gospel to the Gentile than to the Jew?
No.
So then you got to go, oh, what's this all about? Like, why would someone in the first century say something like this? And then how do you solve it? Those are related but important questions. I always love trying to figure out why someone did something. Like, why did they do that? Can I figure that out? If I can, that sometimes helps me understand the reasons why an answer is given. The rationale that God responds to them with and says, no, here's the problem, here's the context, here's the setting. So that sets us up to get to what has a lot of names. Sometimes it's called the Council at Jerusalem. That's a formal title. It's not really that, but it helps kind of figure out. I tend to say it's a gathering of Christians trying to figure out what to do. Like, that's my more natural conversational title. It's like Christians got together and said, what do we do? Because that's kind of fair, right? Have you ever been in a circumstance where Christians had to get together to figure out what to do? Do we give it other titles? You ever been to a business meeting? Gentlemen, raise your hand if you've been to a business meeting. Brethren, if you've been to a congregational meeting. Right, like, so one way or another, you've been involved in a bunch of brethren getting together and trying to figure out what to do. And it actually functions and looks similar to this in many ways. Someone has something to say, someone adds something else to say, and they think about it for a while. Like, it's not that complicated. But let's figure out what takes place here, because I think we might be able to learn how the Spirit participates in events like this and what the outcome is to our big questions. Why are they doing this? And what does God say in response to it? Before we get deeper there, any extra questions, comments, thoughts, insights? Check your caffeine status this morning. If everyone got up at enough time to get an appropriate amount of coffee into their day or whatever method the day starts with. All right, we're good. So this large statement that Luke begins with regarding circumcision, he attaches it in close of verse 1 and end of verse 2 and 3 to the practice of Israel by way of Moses. Like, this is us clinging to our identity. I think that's important to understand that sometimes we think about this action purely in theological terms. Like, God said for Israel to be circumcised, and that was expected of them, and so they did that. But there's another layer to this that I think actually it helps us better understand, and this is the whole sense of their identity. This is what made, among a few other key things, Israelites distinct from the nations around them. In this area, this region of the world, those who are inhabitants of it actually look basically the same. Their languages kind of blend together. There are distinct language groups in the areas around Israel from the time of the founding of the nation of Israel all the way to the first century, but their languages overlap. They use a lot of the same words. They sound very similar. Everyone kind of ended up being bilingual to some degree. You had native and then you had Roman by this point. So how do you identify if someone is one of your tribe, one of your people? And by the way, you do that now, right? We do the same thing right now to identify distinctions amongst community for all kinds of reasons. So I'll ask this question to kind of make a point. How many of you on your automobile have some indication of where you went to college, want to go to college, or where your money went to college? Raise your hands. How many of you got something that says that? Like we do. A lot of people in our family do. So now, okay, that identifies you together. Oh, look, your money went there. That's where you sit your kids. And so, boom, you're identified. You're one of our people. How many of you wear any piece of clothing that identifies a particular town, community, or again, we'll use sports, or a team? Half of us do, right? And the other half actually wear it, but may not realize we're wearing branded clothing that says you're from somewhere. How many of you have traveled overseas, but outside the country? Can you tell when an American walks into a room and someone who's not American, even though we all look the same? You absolutely can, before we say a word, mostly by our clothes, by our attire. It gives us our identity. If you see in the airport overseas an American-looking male, because you can tell, they got a ball cap, they're wearing cargo pants, and they are physically fit, they either work for the State Department or the military. And they're new at their job. If they look like slobs, but they're physically fit, they're probably also Americans and work for the military or the State Department. They're just more experienced and blend in a little bit more. Like, you can tell. You can actually kind of sense it in those international airports. Well, in Israel, everyone still does dress the same. All their food is the same because they all have the same food sources. There's not like there's extra food that only Israel can get access to. So how do you tell someone's an Israelite? Well, speech, behavior, but how do you really tell when they show up to synagogue? and they check. Like, that's like you now are in the secret handshake club. So if you're clinging to that cultural identity and you're going into worship and you're going to be immersed and sanctified before worship, because that's how you enter the synagogue, you're baptized in essence, and you're checked before you go in, they're going to say, well, you can't come in because you're not one of us. But I'm one of you because Jesus said so. I've been baptized. And Paul, one of you, told me to be baptized. That gives us a cultural understanding of some of the draw of an idea that on the first read seems more theological. Well, you should be circumcised because that's what we do. There's also power play issues at hand too, where this asserts their power and dominance over the Gentiles and other things. But really, it's a link to their identity as Israel, both spiritually and physically, that's being attached to them. That leads us to verses 4 through 6. The elders and the apostles met to consider this question in those three or four verses. And again, try to posit what goes down in that conversation. So you have the apostles, grouped, not named. They are just lumped to us in the text as saying, this is going to go on. This is going to be discussed. Remember, Paul and Barnabas have already offered some insight in regards to some background there. But they have to ask a very rational question. By what manner or by what means are we saved? Now, shouldn't the apostles have a quick answer to this, you would think? You would think that this would be like one of those fact check bookend questions, right? Two things to remember. Inspiration is not like the World Wide Web where you can just Google an answer. You can go up. What's the answer to this question? Because just like the World Wide Web, you're going to get some wrong answers if you're just kind of randomly asking questions. But the process of inspiration is God giving them insight, giving them at times what to say, or reminding or remembering things. That's what the text says inspiration functions like. So they still have independent thought they have to go through. And as the behavior of men show us in the Bible of these apostles, they make choices independent of this block of knowledge. Sometimes they don't do what they're supposed to do. Sometimes they ignore principles. And so they have to reason through it as well. And the elders play a part in it. The very elders that in some ways are appointed by these same men. So they're sharing in this process of figuring out what it is to do and how to handle it. Both the question and the solution. So that's what we got going on here, is that process of things. And we'll talk about it later when we get to the verses that follow and like how do you work through a simple question like this. But what are your thoughts here? What do you see going on that's important to you? What details when you're reading your text in preparation for the class or even this morning jump out and say, hey, this is interesting? Michael?
It's kind of, the situation is very relatable. Because sometimes when you're taught something forever, and then you find out, well, that's not actually right. It's hard to let go of that. You know, I think there are probably things 15 years from now, and I realized, Michael, in 2022, you had that wrong. It's hard to change those things, even though you know they're wrong, just because they're ingrained in us.
Yeah. Some of it is thoughtless habit that goes into these structures that we build around us. Where initially we planned out and chose an action, but now we've made it by rote repetition, just the standard way we do things. excuse me. Whether it's physical practice or even our worship, the way we order our worship together sometimes falls into that category where we put a lot of effort early so we can engage in the process, but then we forget the effort and the rationale behind it. So what's going on then in that textual setting, verses 4 through 6, is them trying to figure some of this out. Verse 6, it says, the apostles and elders were gathered together to consider the matter. And after there was much debate, Peter stood up and said to them, and begins to tell them again a story that they should, or more likely, or obviously would have known secondhand. And begins to tell them an example, showed. This is what's going on. He says in particular, verse 7, brothers, you know that in the early days God made a choice among you that by my mouth the Gentiles should hear the word of the gospel and believe in God who knows the heart bore witness to them. And so he begins to indicate for us that this is, hey, pretty simple. God made a choice. I'm supposed to go to give the gospel to them. That's instructive or directive example telling where God told me to do this. You know that this is the case. And you think back to the Grand Commission, as we refer to it, or the Great Commission in the close of Matthew or the close of Mark. The instruction there is to make disciples and then baptize them, not make disciples, circumcise them in baptism, or baptism and baptize them and circumcise them. It's just go make disciples and then baptize them. That's the order of that Grand Commission. And that's what Peter has been doing. And he's selected for the job. But so is Paul. Paul also is identified uniquely as, in a separate class to a certain degree, an apostle just to the Gentiles. So he begins to say, look, this is how it is. And you note later, verse 9, and he made no distinction between us and them, having cleansed their hearts by faith. Now therefore, why are you putting God to the test by placing a yoke on the neck of the disciples that neither our fathers nor we have been able to bear? But we believe that we will be saved through the grace of the Lord Jesus, just as they will. Now, Peter, like the rest of us, gives a little extra with his answer. Because his sentence technically could end with, why are you putting a yoke on them? Period. But there's extra there. He says there's two groups of people who have failed in the past. Who wasn't able to carry this yoke? Yeah. He says, why are you asking them to do something that we ourselves, at least from Peter's perspective, failed to do? Whatever he means by that. It's always important to think, well, what is it going on? So let me ask that question. What do you think Peter means that our fathers or we ourselves were not able to carry that yoke? Part of the answer is they're not able to actually keep the law in a complete sense. Anything else underneath that would be important for us to think about? How about this technical aspect of it? In the law, sacrifices are temporary. They are. They only go forward until the next sacrifice. And the penultimate or grand sacrifice that the law foreshadowed and predicted is Christ. Circumcision, as a practice, though, kind of sets outside the law to a degree. Because you think about these staging of the practices and when they occur and when we get the law and when the law gets codified or expanded or explained, it's adopted into the law. Circumcision is inclusioed into the law. Not from Sinai, because that's when the law was given to him, but it's a prior event to that. And he's basically saying, like, these are things that we've been doing as a people of Israel, all in preparation. And they no longer have the value they once did. And more practically, we didn't even keep them like we should have. Because remember, I got you wrong just a second. At the preaching of the gospel in Acts chapter 2, there is an acknowledgement of moral failure on their hand. Remember the statement, "Ben, brethren, what shall we do?" We crucified the Son of God, but we were the circumcised who should have rallied to welcome the Son of God as part of this circle that's being completed there. Roy?
Circumcision never had anything to do with salvation in the first place. It was like a covenant between them and God. So the false teaching part was, they said, unless you are circumcised, you cannot be saved.
Yeah.
Even they weren't saved by circumcision.
All right, that's what Peter is driving to, that their own redemption isn't based on their status as being circumcised, which in and of itself is male-centric only. It doesn't even catch the larger perspective of redemption. So it's really important for us to catch that aspect of it as well. Goes on, and we encounter our next bit of information. The assembly falls silent, and they listen to Barnabas and Paul as they related the signs and wonders of God that had been taking place through their labor with the Gentiles. And so Peter has his revelation. Paul and Barnabas is very trusted in this group. Paul has been accepted into this group. And he says, look, we've seen this happen. We've seen them receive what we ourselves have received, that God is working among them, and this is how. And it's important that you have those two personalities doing it. Think about that. Barnabas, son of encouragement, and Paul, who had been the son of discouragement. Find a little second name for Paul, because that's really what he was. Absolutely in opposition to everything that the Christians as a community were seeking to accomplish, but now he's folded that and throw it in the trash. And now he's engaged in the kind of work that Barnabas was doing, encouraging, strengthening, admonishing, building. Les?
I don't remember exactly where it is, but in some places they go back and tell them about Abraham, and Abraham was a friend of God and pleasing to God before he was ever circumcised.
Yeah.
And that brings in what Roy was talking about, the covenant and that. So they show it that way, that one that they put so much favor and stock in, Abraham, our father, he was pleasing God before he was.
Right, and that begins to narrow our focus and say, look, we've got to think through this theologically. They started with practically, and then the theology, or what God teaches, God knows, comes into play. And James, when he takes his moment to speak after Paul and Barnabas, cites the prophet Amos in Amos chapter 9, verses 11 through 12. And he says, what we're saying and what we're discussing is something that agrees with the testimony of God. Now again, you have inspired individuals, shepherds, elders, overseers, bishops, pastors in the local church, same job, different titles or descriptions, inspired participants doing the exact same thing that we have to do when we figure out something here. We've asked questions. We've now seen command evidenced, God telling Peter, God showing Paul and Barnabas. And then James is making a kind of a recognition. He's saying, hey, this certainly ties together with what God has said. Because the text in Amos reads, after this I will return, and I will rebuild the tent of David that has fallen. I will rebuild its ruins. I will restore it, and the remnant of mankind, and that the remnant of mankind may seek the Lord. And all the Gentiles who are called by my name, says the Lord, who makes these things known from old. So James cites the Old Testament text and says, this is always known. We didn't pay attention to it. We certainly didn't behave that way. But James is citing an earlier apostle that they should all have recognized. And that kind of caps this argument together in a way that should be important for us to pay attention to. That they've now listened to God telling or commanding Peter. They've seen the example or the showing of Paul and Barnabas and others. And now they've also recognized what that would imply. It would imply a culmination of this biblical passage that James recalls and states for us. And that's how all conversation and rationality works. We all work through everything that same way. Nothing in conversation ever takes place without that same process. It's just the way things work in language. It's just not a complicated thing. But that gets them to their conclusion in verse 19. Like verse 19 is, in particular for James, "Therefore my judgment is that we should not trouble those of the Gentiles to turn to God, but should write to them to abstain from things polluted by from idols and from sexual immorality and from what has been strangled and from blood. For from ancient generations, Moses has in every city those who proclaim him, for he is read every Sabbath in the synagogues." So part of James's answer touches into his concerns. James is the one speaking here, speaking for James, and we read it maybe for the group to a degree. But his answer says, and is connected to, the other Jewish communities in the area where these Gentiles are seeking God exists. It's not so much a full legislative answer that in all places and all things and at all times, but it's a specific reminder to Gentiles who have turned to the Lord that these things are important. Because let me ask you a question. Is, as it's translated in the ESV here, sexual immorality a moral issue that all Christians of every generation and all Jews of every generation need to source out and figure out how to behave? So there has to be a particular reason why this particular issue makes it to the table. Because it's like a repeat otherwise. Further, as James says, things that are polluted from idols, things that are strangled from blood, there are some aspects here that have to tie in uniquely to the Mosaic practice of the law that makes it distinct from the other areas. Because the Bible itself, the teaching of Jesus, actually addresses some of these core areas very distinctly. Jesus addressed morality mostly in the realm of marriage. Individual sexual morality came in terms like adultery and looking upon a woman to lust. It would be as if you committed adultery with her already. And so he uses that marriage box to describe his sexual ethic in the Sermon on the Mount. So in this case, we have a little expansion of it that says there's aspects of it that aren't even discussed in the dialogue that require us to instruct Gentiles to behave differently than they would have been behaving. And so we'll talk about that, what that means here in a second. But thoughts or questions or comments up to this point? Or things that are interesting. That's always a fine thing to bring into the table. All right, we're going to have a letter in a second, which is from verse 26 to the end of our segment, verse 35, to a degree. But let's think about the other writings of some of these men to try to sort out some of the details that might fit into this important addition as they clarify behavior for Gentile converts. Does Paul write anything in his other letters about behavior regarding interaction with members of the other gender, sexual interactions, marriage in his writings to the Gentiles? What does he say in some of those things? You don't have to give a verse if you can't remember the exact verse, but you can talk about principles. So there's an abstinence expectation. What about marriage? Does Paul talk about marriage in light of Christ? And the status of your marriages or any of those things in some of his writings? Talk about remaining in the state you were called. That's an important kind of status reminder. He talks about who you should marry. And if you should marry, right? Does he talk about if you should marry in regards to any particular context? It says, concerning what? It may not be good to take a wife. Tribulation, trial, like there's going to be some rough times ahead. May not be a great thing. But if you marry, he adds some extra reminders for it. And he's writing that particularly to a Gentile audience. Further, does he talk about what we would call unequally yoked marriages? Because that's the term that Paul uses. Can you just abandon that marriage if you're unequally yoked? Like, just do whatever you want? Have you ever thought about what the Jewish practice is regarding how easy their marriages were sundered and broken? Considering Jesus' interactions with the Sadducees and the Pharisees. Like, to the Israelite mind, their marriage contracts were not very firm. Because we see that because when Jesus answers their questions about marriage, divorce, and remarriage, as we kind of qualify them, do they act like Jesus' answer is super chill and they like it? Or do they respond negatively to Jesus' answer regarding the permanency of marriage?
He responded negatively.
Very negatively. So I will suggest to you that this inclusion of sexual immorality in this letter is actually a reminder to live to the standard of the gospel rather than the standard of the Jewish world or the Gentile world. Because in both of those worlds, marriage was more of a commodity than a true bond. And so the inclusion of it here is actually resetting the bar for the Jewish side up. And the Gentile side was told to live to there too. Like, no, you can't act in a way contrary to what you may have already seen. And so that's my suggestion as an understanding as to why this inclusion is there based on looking at the larger picture of things. Aside from the absolute thing that we sometimes need basic reminders. Like, the world pulls you in different directions. And these Gentiles most certainly would have needed that second extra reminder as well. All right, what are you seeing there? I know I gave you a whole complicated list of things to think about. And the standard method of raising your hand or speaking up is fine. Carl, you got something you want to add? That's fine. You're thinking over there. Go ahead.
Their concern was that they would throw away anything that gave them distinction from the world.
Yeah.
So if you get rid of circumcision, you get rid of the law of Moses, they're like, what distinguishes us from the world? So I think he gives them three examples that we're not going to just throw the towel. We're not going to be conforming to the world. There will be a distinction.
Yeah. And on a practical level, these principles here are still ones that occur in humanity today. There are still things where we've got to figure out how do we maintain our distinctive nature as disciples of Jesus as the culture around us swirls in different directions. American culture, we don't really have a big problem of eating things that are strangled. Like, we don't do that. Eating things that are mingled with blood. But you go to a different country, their dietary habits are vastly different. Whenever I have gone to the Philippines, that's actually a thing that is part of their culinary practices, that at some places we have to ask and stipulate, would you make sure that we're not served this? Because we don't necessarily want to cause conflict or create division accidentally. Also, I just don't like it. Side benefit of that. But the practice of the text is really important to me too. I'd rather not. I like things to have seen the fire a little bit for the most part as a dietary choice overseas. So this is not a new thing. It's not an old thing. It's an all the time thing for us to kind of grapple with this reality. And then of note, you have a culmination in verse 22. It seemed good to the apostles and the elders with the whole church to choose men from among them and send them to Antioch with Paul and Barnabas. They sent a Judas called Barsabbas and Silas, leading men among the brothers, with the following letter, and it details these expectations and experiences and synopses, all of this. Note that this letter is sent as instruction. It's sent from the elders in Jerusalem and the apostles. Now here's the question. Does this violate our concept or understanding of what's called autonomy, self-governance? Are they shepherding these other churches in this practice? got to think about that for a second, because wait a minute, you know, elders are supposed to shepherd just their own flock, right? That's the text says that very conclusively. Bobby? The apostles already knew the answer to the question because they were the ones doing the thing that God said for them to do. They're engaged in it. So the elders' inclusion here shows us a little bit more insight into the relationship of Christians in the first century. Note that they're going there to teach what they practice and encourage these other churches to practice the same thing. But note, they are not going there, and it never says that they're going there, to shepherd the church. They are sent there on behalf of these elders to teach, to educate, to instruct. Leading men, Judas, Barsabbas, Silas, apostles, servants, whole spectrum of folks are involved. And it's important for us to recognize that this crucial moment is actually one that's designed for us to think about the tying together of Christians rather than the fracturing of them. Because the unfortunate reality is this particular issue continues to fracture these brethren for a long time. To the point that Peter himself actually struggles with parts of this a little bit down the road. So I just want to remind us when we're reading this that this isn't a instructive text in the regards of do local churches shepherd themselves. But it is an instructive text that tells us that teaching exists in a different space than whatever it is we consider shepherding to take place within. And the contents of the letter show us that this is general admonition for all. Although it's narrow in focus because it's really just for the Gentiles, because whatever it is isn't really focused at Jewish converts at this point, except the implicit or implied aspect of accept your Gentile brethren. They're your brethren. That's the implied other half of it that I think a lot of the Jewish converts to Christ struggled with pretty obviously based on Peter, Galatians, Paul, and the conflict between the two of them. Yeah.
I think if they could properly regard this attitude toward the Gentiles in the city of Jerusalem, they could regard it anywhere.
Yeah.
And so when the elders themselves cite it in Jerusalem, and others see that, they're willing to attach their name to this doctrine, to this teaching, and say, we agree, and we participate.
Yeah. And it's really a great opportunity to latch these things together and say, look, we should be one in our worship and our behavior, and we're in an area, like Carl was pointing out, that wouldn't necessarily do this. This is not the normal Jewish thing to do, to say Gentiles are welcome here. But that's what they're literally saying and practically applying. And I note in the verses that in this section, verse 30 through 35, the outcome is encouraging. This is a letter designed and with the merit and application to be uplifting. My note from that is that when we're engaging in practices like that, we should do the same thing. When we're trying to help others mature their faith, to some degree or another, we need to be people who encourage. And I think that's a great example there as well. Final thoughts. We've got our standard questions up here, but our clock has run out, so I'll just add this. Your life will be surrounded with opportunities to engage in these same kind of things, where you're going to be able to sit, ask questions, and resolve conflict. The model of part of what takes place here is incredibly valuable, where people are given a chance to explain, evidence, information can be given. But I love the conclusion to this is harmony and unity amongst the participants. They work their ways towards a we agree, we share, we understand. That's it for today. We'll continue next Sunday morning. Thanks, everybody. Yeah.